Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Our guest this hour is Lionel Shriver, author of over a dozen novels, including the Orange Prize winner, We Need to Talk About Kevin, and So Much for That, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her latest work is The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047. It opens just 13 years into the future, and the United States has just survived a massive technology collapse dubbed the Stone Age and is now heading toward financial disaster. The Mandibles, heirs to enormous wealth, I should say, are about to see their fortune disappear as society crumbles around them. Ruth Franklin of the New York Times calls The Mandibles a searing exemplar of a disquieting new genre, dystopian finance fiction. We'll see if Lionel Shriver agrees with that assessment as she joins us this hour for Radio Times. Welcome back to the program, Lionel.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Mary.
So dystopian finance fiction, does that work for you?
I had no idea I had started a whole genre, but I'm happy to take credit for it.
So give us a brief sketch to start of the structure of the family. We have a great grandman at the pinnacle.
Yes, he's 97 years old. And you describe the family as wealthy, and technically that's true, but the money is stuck. It's stuck with the oldest member of the family, the patriarch. And that means that everyone has been waiting for many years to inherit. And before they get a chance to, the U.S. goes through a major economic cataclysm and the fortune vanishes. So it's partly an exploration of what effect that has emotionally on the rest of the family.
And Mandible is an interesting choice for the name of this family. Any particular reason why you chose Mandible?
Well, I have to admit there was an element of caprice about it.
Yeah.
I grabbed it out of the air. But on examination, I understood why I liked it. It has a primitive quality. It does, after all, mean jawbone. And it turns out that if you look it up, it not only means that which with which you eat, but it also means eatable.
Hmm.
So that dual quality of eating and eaten is perfect for this book. But most of all, it's that it's got a formidable quality because I wanted this to be an august family, or once august anyway. And it is memorable. I don't know anybody named Mandible, and I hope I never meet anyone named Mandible.
I still haven't
looked up whether or not it is a surname somewhere in the world.
Yeah.
I too badly don't want it to be. It's my surname.
So, okay. So if you would, Lionel, read for us a passage about Florence, who is Douglas Mandible's granddaughter, great-grandman's granddaughter. She hasn't seen much of his money. Work is scarce, but she's managed to find some work. So in setting the scene, here she is answering a question from her partner, Esteban.
Well, Florence is someone who graduated in 2008, and I always felt sorry for people like that. And so Florence is
she's a millennial.
She is a millennial.
Yeah.
She is a and I find her a very sympathetic character. She works for a homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I wish you'd find something else. I do too, but don't tell anybody. It would ruin my sainted reputation. Florence returned to slicing cabbage, an economical option, even at $20. She wasn't sure how much more of the vegetable her son could stand. Others were always agog at the virtuousness of her having taken on such a demanding, thankless job for 4 long years. But assumptions about her angelic nature were off base. After she'd scraped from one poorly paid, often part-time position to another, whatever wide-eyed altruism had motivated her moronic double major in American Studies and environmental policy at Barnard had been beaten out of her almost entirely. Half her jobs had been eliminated because an innovation became abruptly obsolete. She'd worked for a company that sold electric long underwear to save on heating bills, and then suddenly consumers only wanted heated underwear backed with electrified graphene. Other positions were eliminated by what in her 20s were called bots, but which displaced American workers now called robs, for obvious reasons. Her most promising position was at a startup that made tasty protein bars out of cricket powder. Yet once Hershey's mass-produced a similar but notoriously oily product, the market for insect-based snacks tanked. So when she came across a post in a city shelter in Fort Greene, she'd applied from a combination of desperation and canniness. The one thing New York City was bound never to run out of was homeless people.
New York will never run out of homeless people. So what has...
Some things don't change in the future.
Yeah. What, Lionel Shriver, what has happened to leave New York, especially in such a terrible state?
Well, the catastrophe starts slowly, as they often do.
Yeah.
And part of the art of writing this book was to control the plot, to pull the reins on the plot and have things crumble at first quite gradually. But it's primarily to do with the national debt, which has grown so large that the international economy has lost faith in the dollar and has contrived a new international currency called the bankor, which I shamelessly stole from John Maynard Keynes. And that means that the dollar is no longer the primary reserve currency, and its value plummets in the markets. And that has the effect of killing the stock market in the United States. And in response, the president renounces the national debt. We're not going to pay it back.
Hmm. Actually, I know you just read a passage, but we do have a passage from the book that that we'd set aside here from President Alvarado, the country's first Hispanic president. He takes to the airwaves to bring the news to the American people. And it's kind of germane to what we are talking about. So
yeah, we might as well move on to that.
Sure.
What becomes what's called the Great Renunciation later in the book is this speech, which is, you know, one of those addresses to the nation, which begins, as they all do, "Good evening, fellow Americans. Modern warfare comes in many guises. During this past week, our nation has once again been under attack. No towering skyscrapers have tumbled. Both the physical and digital systems on which we depend continue to function. Yet the attack we are currently sustaining is potentially no less devastating than nuclear missiles hurtling toward our cities. What has been targeted is the very medium through which we trade with other nations and conduct commerce with one another, the medium through which our labors are rewarded, our debts are repaid, our tables are laid, and our children are secured medicines for their ailments. What is at risk is no less than the almighty dollar itself. Coordinating their chicanery, countries that wish this nation ill have played on the cowardly compliance of our allies. In the last 10 days, a sequence of carefully timed financial dominoes were toppled, designed to raise the cost of financing our national debt, which would translate into you, the American taxpayer, keeping less of your hard-earned income. Our currency was also sabotaged on the international exchange markets. Most perfidiously of all, world leaders who resent the power, prestige, and success of our great nation have cobbled together the so-called bankor, an artificial pretender currency with no history as legal tender."
Interestingly, this President Alvarado turns the mirror outward in looking for blame for this calamity as opposed to back at his administration.
Well, in this president's defense, he is dealing with an enormous national debt that was not of his making.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he resets the national debt, an idea that might seem far-fetched to many of us here in 2016, but, you know, our very real national debt of $19.5 trillion thereabouts is an uncomfortable reality. Did this help to spark your decision to write this novel?
Oh, certainly. That was part of the inspiration. I mean, after all, we went through 2008, and it was that was the subprime mortgage crisis. But that was rapidly followed by a sovereign debt crisis, especially in Europe, which I followed very closely because partly because I live 9 months of the year in the UK. So I'm interested in European affairs.
And go ahead.
The story of Greece, for example, has been fascinating and isn't over yet.
And Lyle,
so this is the end of a sovereign debt crisis, and a lot of sovereign debt crises end in default. And I am just imagining that the U.S. defaults. But one of the things that you have to bear in mind, if the U.S. were ever to default on its debts, which, by the way, Donald Trump has suggested, is that the main people holding U.S. debt are not the Chinese, although they do have a fair whack of it, but it's other Americans.
And in this book, speaking of China, China is the world's superpower. Are you tapping into perhaps an undercurrent of discomfort in America today regarding China's possibilities here?
Sure. There's certainly a thread going through the book of fear of China. And I think that's common now. And there's a lot of prejudice against the Chinese in this in this book among several characters, and I think that's accurate. And there's one character who observes that it seems as if there's always one group in the United States that it's okay to hate, and in this case, it's the Chinese, and it's meant to be rather ugly.
It's interesting, too, the character of Florence Darkly, she's a white woman and in 2029 living in a predominantly Latino United States. And in The Mandibles, she feels marginalized even as her partner is Hispanic. You kind of turn the tables here on today's majority population.
Well, it's not a majority. It's expected that the Hispanic population in the United States will be at about 30% by 2030. Which is a lot. And that suggests also that while they they're not in majority politically, they will be the swing voters at that point.
Well, what I meant, Lionel, was we turn the tables on the white population of today, which the white population being in the majority, I think, according to the census, until, 2044 or something like that.
Yes. So whites are not about to lose their majority status yet, but by the time the book begins, they're really on the cusp of that. And there are characters, there one in particular, who quite resents that. And it is germane to today's political campaigns.
Yeah, and some of these characters might have at one time called themselves liberal and tolerant, but when the tables are turned, perhaps not so. We'll pick up on that thought in just a moment because we're up against a break, Lionel Shriver. Our guest is the novelist Lionel Shriver. Her latest work is The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047. And if you'd like to join in the conversation here at Radio Times, the number is 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet as well at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. There's more straight ahead. This is WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and here this hour with us is novelist Lionel Shriver. She's written The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047. As always, we're taking calls at 888-477-9499. If you'd like to send along a comment, we'll try to get it on the air. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Lionel, just picking up on a thought that we were following right before the break. The white population is now in the minority. Some who might have thought of themselves as liberal and tolerant are now having a little bit of difficulty with their minority status. Are you poking a bit at what seems to be attitudes of tolerance in this day and age in your book?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm picking up on a resentment that exists right now. And it isn't always pretty, but nobody likes to lose power, do they? And losing majority status is, in a democracy, also ceding political control. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with a lot of Trump supporters, is that all the white people in this country are not going to go quietly. It is upsetting to them.
I actually
play it down in this novel because it's such an incendiary topic that I don't want it to take over. But I thought it was important to represent the demographic progress of the country. And that's why we have a Hispanic president as of 2028. I don't find that incredible.
And interestingly, in your book, Lionel Shriver, Mexico builds a wall.
Yes. I want credit for this because I wrote this book before Trump began his campaign. And if anyone got the idea from anyone else, he stole my idea. However, in my book, Mexico builds a wall, all right, and they pay for it even, but it's to keep Americans out.
And kind of continuing in this vein, there are no more birther arguments either.
The 28th
Amendment
right.
has been ratified.
Because Arnold Schwarzenegger ran for president and had a lot of support, we're no longer requiring that the president be native born. So Dante Alvarado, the 2028 president, was born in Mexico.
Well, the theme of the book is dark, and of course there are certainly moments of humor aside from, you know, the tongue-in-cheek Mexico building the wall. Boomers are now boomer poops, and young people are named Goog and Bing, and I love this. Vladimir Putin is still president of Russia, although he has his shirt on. I've heard, Lionel Shriver, that writing humor can be really challenging. I've not attempted it. If it's not crafted well, I guess it must risk hitting a sour note. So how do you write humor?
I include a lot of humor in all of my work just to keep myself entertained. I mean, after all, you have to remember that while I'm actually writing the book, it's me in a room. I like to make myself laugh. Now, there's always a risk with humor because it's so particular and everyone doesn't find the same things funny.
Sure.
So I have a readership, and I think one of the things that the readership has in common with me and each other is that they have a similar sense of humor. I think that's key. And if you don't find what I find in a broad sense funny, then I'm probably not the author for you. Because to me, that's just – it's such an important part of the tone and the experience of reading the novel. There was one negative review that said that hundreds of pages went by for him without a single joke. And I just thought, oh, well, you're just not getting any of them, or you don't want to.
You're not on the same wavelength.
And so it's like, well, that's just not the book for you. If I happen to hit your funny bone, then I think it's really important that a book like this is entertaining and not just depressing. It's meant to be playful. It is not super, super serious. It's got a dramatic and dire side, but it is meant to tickle you as much as to dishearten.
Well, let's get back to the writing process. I've read that you are a night owl. Give us a sense of the hours you keep, Lionel Shriver.
Now, look, I have said many times, I don't think this is very interesting, and it doesn't make me special. I keep the same hours as anyone else. They're just later. So I will often work till 10 or 11 at night, get a little exercise, have some dinner, and go to bed at 4 in the morning. And I get up at 11. And that's just the schedule that I naturally fall into. The main problem with it is that, especially in London, for some reason, plumbers and electricians insist on showing up at 8 in the morning. And to me, that's the middle of the night.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering if you got flack from this, you know, about from others in your life, like your agent who has to book appearances. This has to be the equivalent of 6 in the morning for you.
Yes, I and even to speak with you today, I definitely had to set an alarm. Getting up at 9 takes a lot of discipline for me.
Well, we thank
but
you
it was
that.
Worth it.
So it's all right. So back to the writer's process. You're by yourself. Do you like quiet? Do you mind noise? Do you, you know, mind interruptions? And how long does the process take from start to finish for any particular novel?
Well, whether I mind interruptions doesn't matter. Let's put it this way. I'm married to a jazz drummer.
Is he drumming in the next room?
Sometimes, or he'll have a rehearsal, right, with all his other band members, and so you know, I've learned to work through. I could work through nuclear war. I'm very good at just completely tuning other people out.
Yeah. Well, at least it sounds as if you're on the same schedule or a similar schedule.
Yes, it's one of the things that makes us get on, because he's often playing gigs and won't get back until, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. And that works out great for both of us.
Sure. All right. So let's get back to some of the issues your book touches on. So Douglas Mandible, great grandman, blames decades of American fiscal policy for the crisis, saying the American dollar is worthless now, not because of the rate spike and not because of crashing on the international currency exchange and not because of the bank war. It's worthless now because it was worthless before. So is this something that you're kind of examining here, Lionel Shriver? Is the American dollar essentially worthless in your opinion?
Well, you know, if you look at the history of the value of the dollar, it is shocking. As Douglas Mandible points out, about 100 years ago, what is a dollar today? A dollar 100 years ago was worth a penny now.
Hmm.
I mean, I find that depressing. And, you know, one of the things that currency is for is to act as a store of value. And it doesn't. The dollar doesn't. No, the dollar actually acts as a store of value better than a lot of other currencies, which is why it's used as a reserve currency elsewhere in the world, not just here. But, you know, we've been trained to expect inflation, and we've even been trained to believe that we need inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But I challenge that. I think that's a convenience for government, especially a government that's in debt. Because inflation is good for debtors.
Right, we're having a conversation with novelist Lionel Shriver. Her latest book is The Mandibles of Family, 2029 to 2047. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So Lionel, just want to touch on one of the more chilling notes to this story. The act of chipping, the character of Willing, who is Florence's son, at some point in this story, he needs to do this chipping to find work. And if you would, just read one more passage for us about that.
Sure. And I should explain that this is in 2047. It's in the second part of the book. And Willing has had done what everyone does. It's like going out and getting a social security number, only in this case you get a chip implanted at the back of your neck. Willing did not believe the federal government controlled his mind. He accepted that the chip performed the functions it was purported to. It registered direct deposits of his salary. It deducted the costs of any products he chose to buy. It debited his utility bills. Though Willing had no experience of either, it recorded investments and received state benefits. It subtracted local, state, and federal taxes, which totaled 77% of his pay. It communicated his every purchase to the agency known until 2039 as the Internal Revenue Service. What the item cost, when and where he bought it, and the product's exact description, down to model, serial number, or sell-by date. It informed the American tax authorities if he bought a packet of crackers. Were the chip to accumulate in excess of fiscal reserves, an amount that surpassed what he required on average to cover his expenses for the month, it would dun the overage at an interest rate of -6%. Should the balance cross various thresholds, that interest rate would progress up to -21%. Saving was selfish. Saving was bad for the economy. Negative interest rates also provided Americans a short course in mathematics from which an undereducated public could surely benefit. At -21% compounded annually, $100 was worth $30.77 5 years later. Any additional income, including gift coupons for a birthday, revenue from pawned possessions, bake sale proceeds, and private party poker winnings, would also register on the chip and would also be taxed at 77%. Chipping solved the problem of the hackable, stealable, long dysfunctional credit card. Chipped. You were a credit card.
Well, this is a pretty dark view of how much we're willing to give up of ourselves, Lionel Shriver. I mean, granted, this is how many decades into the future, this imagining, but technology today is amazing and a little scary. And realistically, how much do you think we're willing to give up in terms of privacy? Seems like willing's given up everything.
I don't find this incredible. And the truth is that we already live in a world where the government considers all of our financial transactions essentially its business. Certainly all of our earnings are the government's business. And we kind of slid into this. And that this is where I have to declare my rough libertarian leanings. I'm not sure that if you are not free economically, you are truly free. And so I'm literalizing that. But the tax rate that Willing is noting that he pays, and he's doing grunt work. So this is paying 77% at the lowest level, and you can imagine it goes up.
Mm-hmm.
That is not ludicrous considering what kind of a support ratio we're looking at in the middle of this century. That is, we could have a close to a one worker supporting one person who's retired or a child around that time. And so, we're always talking whenever we talk about the national debt, we're piling it on our children. Well, This is trying to illustrate that the burdens of my generation, I'm a baby boomer, are going to be very real. I could still be alive by 2047, and although not necessarily in the greatest of health. And I'm concerned that people like the person who becomes my main character, Willing Vanderbilt, is going to be saddled with the likes of me.
Hmm. So Lionel Shriver, Ruth Franklin of the New York Times, I'll go back to her. She says, in regards to you, her new novel establishes her firmly as the Cassandra of American letters. And Cassandra, the figure in Greek mythology who had the gift of prophecy, but was fated never to be believed. What do you think about that from Ruth Franklin, Lionel?
Well, it's in some ways a dubious compliment. I have found some of the connections between some details in this book and Trump a little forbidding. It's almost as if I brought him into the world. I think that the dystopian novel is intrinsically a format for forewarning, for
sure,
sounding the alarm. That is what they are for. And what most disheartens me about this novel, however, is that it's sounding a warning, all right, but it doesn't make it clear what the solution is. In fact, I had somebody at an event recently ask me, you know, so what are you telling us to do? And I was completely flummoxed.
Well, that was my next question. What do you want readers to take away from this book? You don't know.
Well, I guess I'm interested in sovereign fiscal prudence. That's about all I'm arguing for. But I can say that. But the truth is that the entitlement burden, once we get to about 2030, is going to be so fantastic that I don't know how we're going to be reining in the national debt. Not and continue to pay Social Security and cover people like me with Medicare.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just the United States. What becomes of the European Union in this novel?
The European Union is in even worse shape.
Yeah.
But I did get rid of the euro. There's a reference to the orderly unwinding of the euro, which takes about 10 years. That's a little mischievous, but I do think that it's a dysfunctional currency, and I would not be at all surprised if they end up having to backtrack on it.
Yeah. You're also quoted as saying that being part of the European Union would never fly for the United States, and I'd never even gone there, but why do you think it wouldn't work? We've actually got about 20 seconds before the break. So.
Right. and you bring up Brexit. Well, yeah, that's cruel.
Well, that's going to come up, sure.
the U.S. Would never submit to being part of an organization whose laws and rules trump Congress and the president. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
Well, we will address Brexit, so brace yourself, Lionel Shriver, coming up after the break. Lionel, her latest work is The Mandibles of Family, 2029, 2047. And if you'd like to join the conversation here at Radio Times, here's the number, 888-477-9499. There's more of Radio Times in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and our guest is novelist Lionel Shriver. She's written The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047. And as always, we're taking calls at 888-477-9499, or if you'd like, send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So we won't belabor Brexit, but I do feel we should bring it up just because London is your home, mm-hmm. Lionel, for most of the year, right?
Yes, generally September to June.
So what appeals to you about London?
Well, part of it is that I'm terribly lazy and have no capacity to learn foreign languages. And so they speak English. And that is so that it's the best of both worlds. It's foreign up to a point, but not very.
Hmm. Tell us about Brexit. Did you expect it?
I didn't. I mean, I supported Brexit,
you
and
did.
That put me at odds with all of my friends.
Sure.
Bar one, come to think of it. And but I did not expect that the Leave camp would win. Sometimes it's important to admit when you are wrong. And I went around predicting that not only was the Remain camp going to win, but they were going to win by a much greater margin than the polls had predicted.
Where is
I was flat out wrong.
You were not Cassandra that time. So where is Britain going to be in a year, do you think?
Well, it'll still be a part of the European Union. They haven't triggered Article 50 yet, which mm-hmm. starts the process in motion, and that takes 2 years. Yeah. So, you know, the UK is now in a funny state of having voted for radical change, and yet nothing's happened.
Radical,
the only
slow
thing that's
change.
Really happened is that the pound has dropped in value, but everything is still the same. The UK is still in the EU and still has to obey all those niggly little rules.
Mm. So what is the emotional temperature of your friends, your family in London, your neighbors?
Well, I've been in New York for the summer, but I did just go back to do the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. And what really took me aback in conversations with people, and a number of my friends were up from London, is how charged it is. You know, there's always been a political divide between the supporters of the Tory and Labour parties, in the same way that there is between Democrats and Republicans in this country. But this is different. It's different in texture, in depth, and in acrimony. And the people who voted to remain in the EU are incredibly bitter and resentful and angry. And it's personal. So admitting to these people that you were on the other side, I mean, I'm not a citizen, so I didn't actually vote to leave. So they can't exactly blame me. But, you know, you have to think twice whether you want to open your mouth. Well,
really?
Yeah, actually, I think it's a good thing because it's so nasty. And people are likely to think badly of you, not just politically, but as a person.
Well, let's get to the United States then. You mentioned earlier, Lionel Shriver, that you are roughly libertarian. I think that's how you put it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel sometimes, you know, spending much of your time in London, that you're removed from the presidential campaign process?
Well, you know, being an American somewhere else in the world, and especially somewhere else English speaking, is different from being other foreigners elsewhere. That is, everyone follows our politics so closely and is involved in our politics, especially a race like this one. So it isn't difficult to keep up with the nitty-gritty. And then you add the internet and the ability to, you know, read the New York Times on your tablet. And I don't feel especially cut off. It's more that I managed to get the best of both worlds that I can follow British politics up close and personal, and at the same time keep a hand in with American ones. So it just means that I live in a slightly larger world than other Americans. But I don't think that it entails a sacrifice entirely of keeping up with the U.S. After all, I set a lot of my books in the U.S., and so I have to keep a finger on the pulse.
And as a person who leans libertarian, how would you characterize the campaign?
Well, of course, as a person who leans libertarian, I have nobody to vote for. Even most so-called libertarian candidates are not actually libertarian. I mean, after all, Rand Paul is anti-abortion, and that's not a natural libertarian position. I use that word loosely, and I'm aware of the fact that libertarianism has been it has a little bit of a kooky quality. We're regarded as a little crazy.
Outliers.
yes. But the truth is that, I actually have quite mainstream liberal social opinions, but I am a fiscal conservative. I prefer a smaller government and a balanced budget like that. But that means I have nobody to vote for because I fall between the stools. There is no party in the United States that is socially liberal and fiscally conservative.
Well, stay tuned, Lionel Shriver, right? You'll probably be in London November 8th, I'm guessing.
Yes, yeah. And I will be voting by absentee ballot.
Okay. Well, let's get to an email from Eric who asks, does Lionel Shriver favor a return to the gold standard as a guard against inflation and debt?
I don't know whether it is realistic to go back to a gold standard. A little shockingly, all of the currencies in the world today are so-called fiat currencies. That is, they're based on nothing. They're backed by nothing. Nobody is using the gold standard anymore. Now, I am sympathetic with people who are nostalgic for it because it did seem to keep a lid on inflation, and it did seem to help preserve the value of currency. But it's a little mysterious why, because while even when the dollar was backed by gold, you couldn't walk into a bank and hand in your money and take gold away.
Sure.
That was dispensed with a long time ago. And furthermore, even if you do back a currency by gold, that doesn't mean that you can't subdivide the value of a dollar infinitely, if you know what I mean. You know, so that you can make less and it represent less and less gold. There's nothing conceptually about a gold standard that means that you don't have any inflation. At the end of the novel, I don't want to give too much away.
Sure.
But you arrive in a different place that has a gold standard, and there's a walk-on character who explains that, you know, everyone agrees it's kind of stupid, but for some reason it works.
Let's get back to the novel for just a moment, The Mandibles. The subtitle on the cover says, "In God We Trusted." And aside from the reference to legal tender, is in this dystopian place, is there room for God or faith?
I have to confess that one of my blind spots as a fiction writer is that my characters are rarely religious.
And so, you come from a religious upbringing.
And there's a connection between those facts.
Yeah.
I festively rebelled against my Presbyterian upbringing. And so I am not religious. And therefore, I hardly ever write religious characters. I'm afraid that to give my characters religion is to make them foreign to me. This is an impulse that I don't entirely understand, which I realize my saying that is perverse given that my father was an ordained Presbyterian minister, and I was raised with religion coming out my ears. Mm. But I have never genuinely believed in God, so I didn't lose my faith. I never had it to begin with. And I don't understand the religious impulse. I was reflecting on this recently, and I could think of one character across 12 novels who was religious, and he was a minister in New Hampshire in So Much for That. Mm-hmm. And I have to give myself credit. It's a sympathetic character, and he says some wise things. Though even that character, by the very end of the novel, loses his faith in God. So I couldn't control myself.
You address, of course, we've talked about this, you address some tough narratives in your work, financial catastrophe in The Mandibles, also teen violence in We Need to Talk About Kevin, in Big Brother, I guess it's obesity. So are you drawn to difficult current social issues and trends?
I have been. But I have to say I want to make sure I don't always have to take on a big issue. It's not the main reason that people read fiction, and I'm well aware of that. And even when I do take on an issue, I try never to forget that fiction readers want good story. And if I've got something to teach them along the way, fair enough, as long as I can candy coat it and put it in the mouths of my characters and make it entertaining, which I always try to do. So I don't mind educating you in something, but it has to serve the story, and it has to serve the characters. And I have written books that have nothing to do with politics or the headlines in any way, and I always want to preserve the right to just tell a tale and write about timeless subjects. And I think one of the keys to writing even about very current subjects is to have something timeless in the background. After all, The Mandibles is about money and therefore necessarily about value and what we value. And that's forever, you know, and what it's like to lose a lot of money. What function does money serve in our relationships? How does it distort our relationships? I mean, I was interested in exploring, for example, the way when the family's fortune goes away, the relationship between the old man in the book, the 97-year-old, and his son is much better. Mm-hmm. Because finally the son is not tippy-toeing around his father trying to preserve his inheritance.
Sure. Well, Lionel Shriver, we have just enough time to squeeze in a caller here before we wrap up the show. So let's go to Dennis in Reading. Welcome to Radio Times, Dennis.
Hello. It's actually Denise.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Denise. My parents did what Lionel did, or I guess Lionel changed their name, but naming me something kind of generic neutral, you know, for a name. But I just read the book over the weekend and so enjoyed it. It was
Oh, I'm so
amazing.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah,
thank you.
I love dystopian fiction. I maybe this is something about me or maybe not, but I enjoyed it because it reminded me of my grandparents who were born in 1920 and grew up through the Depression, and kind of like all the stories they told me. And so this was sort of like a futuristic story that like my grandparents would have told me about, you know, how the economy works and how life works, and don't get hung up on the money, you know, and at the same time respect it, right? Like, and what it's doing. And the other part about this story is the whole part about the entitlement reminded me of Albert Brooks' story about 2030. It was called 2030, The Real Story of What Happens in America. And it was a bit of a dark humor about how the whole country is revolving around entitlement to the point that we put retired people on cruise ships. And you
I haven't
know,
read
people
that.
Just yeah, it was amazing. So did that inspire your novel, or you know what?
No, I haven't read it, but I'll put it on the list.
And Denise, I want to thank you for your call to Radio Times. We are up against the top of the hour here. She mentioned Lionel that you did change your name years ago. Was that part of your festive rebellion?
Well, look, I ended up spending the rest of my life naming other people who don't exist. I might as well get to name myself first. The short version is I didn't like my name and I wanted to change it. But I think there was a kind of typically American urge in there toward self-creation, self-invention.
Yeah. Why Lionel? Was it just something that...
There is no reason. I was a tomboy. I don't think it was a coincidence that I picked a boy's name. But otherwise, I just like the sound of it.
So are you working on another novel right now?
No, I'm working on a collection. I've never published a collection, and I've been steadily accruing a set of short stories and two major full-length novellas, all of which center on property. So I'm going to call it Property.
Okay. Well, and just one more quick question. So when you are doing your work and when you finally present your work to your editor, what is your relationship with the editor? And is it tough to take criticism of the words you've spent so much time crafting?
Well, no one wants to take criticism. And the only thing you really want to hear from your editor is, this is the most wonderful book I have ever read. It is already perfect. We're going to put it into production now. unfortunately, that's never happened to me.
Yeah. Well, listen, I unfortunately have to stop you there. It was a wonderful conversation. Lionel Shriver, thank you so much for joining us here for Radio Times.
Oh, I had a ball. Thanks for having me.
Lionel Shriver's latest novel is The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047. And her earlier works include We Need to Talk About Kevin and So Much for That. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is Radio Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Mary Cummings Jordan hosts Radio Times Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at 11. Kevin Griffin, our engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Liz Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane, host and executive producer. Tomorrow on the show, we will celebrate the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, also what science tells us about marijuana. Hope you can join us. Thank you.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, offering precision cancer treatment and technology. At CTCA in Philadelphia, each patient has a dedicated care manager to help coordinate every aspect of care, from scheduling appointments to managing your treatment. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.